On the program today, a couple of words on taxes, Harvey on small businesses, and getting the oil changed in your electric car. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday, August the 30th. Glad you could be here, as we always are, everybody. There will be many, many, many words written and spoken about the American tax code in the coming weeks and months. We begin today with some of them spoken by the President of the United States, bully pulpiting as he was on tax reform in Springfield, Missouri this afternoon.
Here are my four principles for tax reform.
This is going to be the condensed version of the speech, by the way.
First, we need a tax code that is simple, fair, and easy to understand.
Amen.
Second, we need a competitive tax code that creates more jobs and higher wages for Americans.
Okay.
The third principle for tax reform is a crucial one. Tax relief for middle-class families.
Yes.
Fourth and finally, we want to bring back trillions of dollars in wealth that's parked overseas.
Well, hang on a minute. Last time we did this, tax repatriation, that's called, American companies spent most of the $350 billion they brought back into this country on dividends and share buybacks. All right, going on, back to the speech.
I want to work with Congress, Republicans, and Democrats alike on a plan that is pro-growth, pro-jobs, pro-worker, and pro-American.
Okay, but it has to be said here, the White House doesn't actually have a tax plan. There's a one sheet, some bullet points, but that's it. No details, no specifics on this thing at all. Down in the Gulf Coast and in Houston today and during the past 72 hours, moving on as we are, there has been a natural study in organizational behavior going on. A lot of the first responders have been civilians, self-organized into rescue squads with the support and approval of government agencies who have realized that locals can move faster and smarter than any bureaucracy can. It's an approach to disaster management that is becoming codified, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
If you were near West Houston and checked Facebook this morning, you might have seen a post going around directing people to the Elks Lodge in nearby Katy, Texas.
We have our kitchen open. We are fixing hot meals for those who need to come in and get a hot meal. We have clothing and blankets and towels.
Kathy Kosick runs the Katy Elks Lodge.
Well, not a shelter, but we can be a staging point for people to come get dry and fed.
By 9 a.m., a dozen or so families were putting themselves together at the lodge. Now, nobody asked Kosick to do this. No FEMA official organized for this to happen.
We just decided to do it for our community. It's what Elks do. I know that sounds cliche, but that's what we're here for.
The reality is that in a major disaster, first responders are often neighbors or volunteers, just people who want to help.
Sometimes it's something that people overlook.
Tricia Wachtendorf is director of the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware. She says 500,000 people were evacuated in New York after 9/11 by volunteers without any plan. Community response is something federal officials have counted on since at least the 90s.
It's a mindset for FEMA for how they should be working in their community, how they should see that value in these community groups.
In the response to Harvey, state disaster officials have encouraged anyone with high water vehicles or boats to help out. A community, Wachtendorf says, is more than just officials. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Here's kind of an amazing statistic from FEMA, and not a good one either. 40% of businesses that close during a disaster, FEMA says, never reopen. And of those that do, nearly a quarter of them fail within a year. Marketplace's Ryan Kyloff explains what's going on.
Russell Rhodes is CEO of the Noose Sport Shop in Kinston, North Carolina. That's N-E-U-S-E.
The Noose River was named after the Noosiak Indian. The Noose River runs beside our store.
It's the Noose River that overflowed and flooded his store during Hurricane Matthew. Remember that huge storm that hit the southeast last October? It was the worst possible timing for Rhodes.
October is our busiest month of the year. Fall fishing, fall hunting, that's the opening month of deer season. We lost the entire month of October.
Rhodes had flood insurance, the maximum he could buy, $1 million. That covered some damage to the building and lost inventory. But Rhodes was closed for three crucial weeks, no money coming in. He missed out on nearly a fifth of his annual revenue. Flood policies don't cover that, what's called business interruption.
That's a little different than you would find from other types of losses.
Don Griffin is VP of an insurance trade group, the Property Casualty Insurers Association. He says roads lost income would have been covered in a different disaster.
Things like fire, windstorm, hail, theft, riots.
Roads would have gotten a check for the lost revenue, temporary employees, rent on a temporary space.
Those coverages are just not included in a flood policy.
Businesses on Harvey's path now face the same problem. Congress could change that next month. There's a proposal to add business interruption to the National Flood Insurance Program. But Griffin says that would likely drive up premiums. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, which I got to tell you seems spiritually very far away from Houston, Texas, tech was the big winner. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A lot of what the Trump administration's been doing that's been perceived as business-friendly has, in the absence of legislation, been done by regulation. Today, another example of that, the White House has delayed an Obama-era program that would have obliged companies to report how much they pay workers of different races and genders as a way to get a handle on the ethnic and gender pay gap. President Trump, though, says there is a better way to get that data. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is on it.
The Obama initiative would have been implemented by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or EEOC. Acting EEOC Chair Victoria Lipnick says one way to take on the pay gap, better enforcement of the Federal Equal Pay Act by her agency. Another approach, she says, give companies incentives.
To really look at their pay practices and do a comprehensive pay analysis.
Lipnick acknowledges that not all companies would do that. Vicky Shabo is vice president of the National Partnership for Women and Families. She says voluntary compliance won't narrow the pay gap. That takes government action.
The private market solution is really belied by the realities of how things work.
Shabo's group says white women are paid only 80 cents for every dollar a man earns. African-American women, 63 cents. Economist Veronique de Rougie at the conservative Mercatus Center says there's another place to look for answers, the economy.
When the economy is booming, the negotiation power shifts to the employees.
Vicky Shabo of the National Partnership for Women and Families says,
I think that's quite wishful thinking.
Shapo says we've had a wage gap in good times and bad. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Robots, we're often told, are going to eat our jobs. You look around and you say, yeah, sure, it could be. Just this week, we learned Domino's is going to partner with Ford to develop driverless pizza delivery cars. That's like two jobs right there. Amazon is testing stores with no clerks or checkout lines, as you might have heard. However, we are not being replaced by computers just yet. James Surowiecki writes about the robopocalypse in Wired. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Why are you so confident that we need not worry about the robopocalypse?
I think because the overwhelming evidence from what's happening in the economy suggests that the robopocalypse, in which robots essentially replace all or, let's say, most human jobs, is a very, very long way off. We just do not see any real evidence of it happening right now, nor in the short to medium term future.
You look at a couple of things in this piece. The first two are literally the unemployment rate and also worker productivity in this economy.
Yeah, productivity is the most important one, I think, to look at, because obviously the premise behind automation and why you would want to hire robots is that they are more productive than humans generally. In other words, they can do more in the same amount of time. And if you employ a lot of robots and replace humans, productivity should skyrocket. I mean, that's what you would expect to see. In fact, we've seen exactly the opposite. Productivity has been historically slow over the last, 10 or 15 years, and it's been especially slow over the last 3 or 4 years when fears of automation and robots have really ratcheted up. And it's literally the opposite of what you'd expect to see if there was a lot of automation going on, knocking human beings out of jobs.
Lots of statistics in this piece. My favorite is this one. Of the 271 occupations listed on the 1950 census, only one of them has been rendered obsolete by automation by the year 2010, and that is elevator operator. I love that.
Yeah, so that was a great study that was done, and the other obvious one that you would think of would be switchboard operator. There aren't very many switchboard operators left. My grandmother actually used to do that, and that job is. But in general, while automation has been a constant force in capitalism really for the last 200 years, automation tends to sort of complement jobs rather than replace them entirely. So parts of a job will get automated, but in general, jobs as a whole don't necessarily disappear.
One of the things you heard and have been hearing in the NAFTA debate that President Trump has started and in the globalization debate that's been going on in this country for a while is, you know, we're losing so many more jobs to automation in this country than we are to actual outsourcing. What do you make sense of that? How do you make sense of that?
Yeah, that's a very familiar and very understandable thing. I mean, you know, it's a logical thing to think, you know, we have all these robots on the assembly lines, et cetera, and therefore that's the reason the jobs are disappearing. I think the economic evidence at this point suggests that trade, and in particular trade with China since 2000, has been responsible for many, many, many more lost American jobs than automation has. Really, the jobs lost to trade is just an order of magnitude greater.
There is a case to be made that automation, when it comes in force, is going to be good for this economy.
Yeah. So one of the ironies of this whole debate is that, you know, we have a lot of sense of concern about the slow economy, the fact that wages are relatively stagnant. And then there's this question of, you know, how are we going to pay for Social Security and Medicare and all these kinds of things? If automation really kicks in, economic growth should rise very sharply. So we will then face the question of how do we distribute the benefits of that economic growth? And that's obviously a complex question. You know, it actually would be probably better if we had more robots and if AI actually kicked in more quickly than it looks like it's going to kick in.
James Surowiecki, he writes for Wired on the robopocalypse and how it's not coming quite yet. James, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on, Kai.
Coming up.
What we often worry about is, what about our retailers?
When your business is books that aren't meant for e-readers. That's straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 27 today, a 10%, 21,892. The NASDAQ up 66, 1%, 6368. S&P 500 up 11 points, 0.4%, 2457. Energy stocks down today. ExxonMobil moved off 0.4%. Chevron down about 0.1%. And Anadarko Petroleum trickled down 0.4% as well. Financial stocks were up, though. Bank of America up 1.7%. Citigroup up 0.7%. J.P. Morgan Chase rang up about 0.2%. Tax preparer H&R Block down 8.2% after announcing it's not planning any major cost-cutting measures this fiscal year. Bond prices fell just a hair. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.13%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do. So great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so you go out to your driveway, you start your car, that light comes on that tells you it's time for an oil change. You ignore it. Come on, you know you do, because you know you don't really have to change your oil every 3,000 miles. Every 5,000 is plenty, thank you very much. Soon, though, it's going to be every never 1,000 miles, because the future of driving, as we all know, is electric, and that's going to mean no more oil changes. Truth is, there's a whole host of changes coming to how our cars run, which will in turn mean changes to the businesses that keep them going. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim lays it out.
Mechanics are coming around to the electric vehicle revolution, but they're doing it at their own pace. That means at this point, you can sometimes see the full range of responses on a single street. Let's start at Hyperion Auto Repair on Hyperion Avenue in Los Angeles. Alex Beltayans had this shop for nearly two decades. He learned how to fix cars from
uncles, father, trade school, and then work.
Work that spans, he figures, about 35 years. Baltayan is one of those mechanics that customers recommend to their friends. They love him. He loves cars.
I love how they look. I love how they sound. I love how they drive.
But a lot of these things he loves about cars are tied to the internal combustion engine. He knows EVs are the future, but he's not too concerned.
I'll learn to work on electrical cars. So to be honest, I'm 54 years old. I'm thinking another 5 more years and then I'll retire. So the gasoline cars will be around that long, so I'll be okay.
Just a few blocks down, also on Hyperion Avenue, stands a bright red, sleek garage that's getting a jump start on the future. Electric Avenue.
We're trying to be a part of this amazing change to hybrid and electric cars.
Harry Bagchajan is in his 20s. He opened this place about a year ago. Like our first mechanic, cars run in his blood. His dad has a traditional shop. On the garage floor, some of his guys are tooling under a hood.
We're changing the transmission.
The staff also changes a lot of belts, replaces water pumps, familiar sounding stuff. Right now, most electric car repairs get done at the dealer. Bagchajan's ramping up his shop's expertise to offer an alternative.
It takes time because the dealer doesn't release some of the software. You got to get it slowly as they release it. But, I mean, we're going to be at the forefront whenever we can be.
Servicing electric cars is a different business proposition. Tony Seba is co-founder of RethinkX, a think tank on disruption. It's researched the impact of electric and self-driving vehicles. EV engines are, in some ways, much simpler.
The electric vehicle has about 20 moving parts, and the internal combustion engine automobile has about 2,000.
And electric vehicle parts get less wear than those in gasoline vehicles, which are essentially powered by explosions. He says the low-maintenance model of EVs means thousands and thousands of repair shops will close. But cars of the future will still need repairs on brakes, suspension, windshield wipers. And a short ways from the Electric Avenue garage, one business is banking on a model that does those things fast. At Valvoline Instant Oil Change, the action is unceasing. The team is designed to get cars out the door as quickly as possible.
Hold it, ready for seconds, Bayon!
William Smelly is VP of Marketing and Sales for Henley Enterprises. It's Valvoline's largest franchise with 221 stores. While its key offering, that instant oil change, won't even be needed in electric cars, he's confident the company can adapt. He brings up hybrids.
We went from never doing those to, oh my gosh, now there's hybrids. Are you going to be able to do those? And we do all those vehicles. So it'll just change.
He says it's the instant that brings in customers, more so than the oil change part.
Our goal is customer service and customer's time, and that's how we'll evolve.
As for how long the company might keep the words oil change in its name, no word on that just yet. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Book publishing can be a difficult business. A retail market that's been turned on its head. Incredibly long lead times to get product to market. One way to thrive? Find your niche and stick to it. A la Chronicle Books out of San Francisco, California. Today's conversation from the corner office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Chronicle's a little bit different than your standard publishing house. Let me read you some of their titles so you get a sense. Game of Thrones coloring book. Star Trek Cats, the coffee dictionary as well. Terrell Mahoney is the president of Chronicle Books. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kai. Great to be here.
Tell me what Chronicle Books is, would you?
Sure. Chronicle Books is a publisher based here in San Francisco. We're one of the largest publishers of illustrated nonfiction. We work across all sorts of lifestyle categories, whether it's cookbooks, wellness, pop culture. And we also have a large children's division where we do picture books, board books, and some YA middle grade books.
YA, young adult, right?
Young adult, sorry.
No, just remembering my days working at Borders, but that's a whole different thing.
Did you work at Borders?
I did work at Borders, yes. Before, actually, that I was working at Borders before I got into public radio, but that's a whole different
what
thing.
What store
and
number?
And also, I'm interviewing you, by the way.
Sorry.
I don't remember the store number.
I would love to hear about your days at Borders.
It was the one down in Palo Alto.
Okay.
It used to be in the theater on University Avenue.
I know it.
So it's an interesting thing that you do because it's not just books, right? It's all kinds of other sort of addenda that feel good and tangible in the hand, right? And you have to get people into retail stores and it's all of that.
Retail is critical for us because it is the experience. Our books really have to be discovered. They can be found in a store. They're merchandised with all sorts of other products sometimes, or in a bookstore on a shelf, or even on a table alongside other types of gifts, stationery, and best-selling novels. We really are very distinct.
Is Jeff Bezos and Amazon your worst nightmare, or what?
It's complicated. Amazon has been a great customer of ours, and they have been an incredible. They've offered incredible convenience to people who want to buy books. What we often worry about is, what about our retailers? There is some serendipity that happens at a store. And really, it's a Chronicle book that often benefits from that kind of discovery.
Was there an aha moment when you realized you couldn't just be at Barnes & Noble or Borders? You had to be in you know, food supply stores and all that?
There was. I wasn't in my time, but there was the story goes that the president of the company for the last 40 years, he was also the sales rep back in the, I think, late 80s, and he went to Barnes & Noble to present our full fall front list, which is our new titles. And he came back with no orders for any books. And that was the moment where he and others thought, we got to figure out a different way of bringing books into the market. We can't, I think he said, we can't build our house all around Barnes & Noble.
Who, I wonder, though, is your competition? Is it the Penguins and the Random Houses, or is it somebody else that I'm not even thinking of?
Well, it's a lot more of the bigger publishers have kind of figured out what we do and what we do well and are trying to emulate that. And more specifically, if you were to look at Random House or any other big publisher 15 years ago, they really didn't care about where else they could sell books outside of the big bookstores, whether it was Borders, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. And here we were, a publisher that was creating visual books that we knew had an opportunity to be discovered as a gift in anything from a small gift shop on downtown Main Street to a pet store to a gourmet store. That is now something those bigger publishers are figuring out and trying to be a part of.
You've been running the place for a year, plus or minus, right?
Minus 7 months in, not counting.
Okay. All right. Well, this is perhaps a front-loaded question then, but with an identity as clearly established as Chronicle Books has established it, where do you take this company next? What's your big thing going to be?
So when I look out into the future, of course, I'm thinking about how do we stay on trend? You know, the publishing business is not a fast-moving business. We're acquiring a book today, and it'll probably be out there 18 months, 24 months from now.
Wow.
So that is a challenge.
Yeah.
And for me, it's thinking about how do we move more quickly, I think, is what I'm mostly concerned about. A couple of years ago, we saw a meme that was starting to take hold and gain popularity, and it was Grumpy Cat. I don't know if you've
heard
of this guy.
Yes.
But we saw this. We thought it was hilarious. We were lucky enough to get a book deal pretty quickly, and we probably got out in the market in 12 months.
Ooh,
and we had
zippy.
A huge success. We sold 500,000 copies of that little, and it's a girl, that little gal's
I didn't know that.
Funny comments and pictures it is. But how often we can do that is, I think, less and less. Really finding something that will still be of interest 12, 18 months from now.
Tara Mahoney, she is the president of Chronicle Books. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's great.
There is more where that came from, the rest of our interview, and all the conversations from the Corner Office on our Corner Office podcast. This final note on the way out today, in which I combine a pet peeve and the city of Aspen, Colorado. Peeve first. If you work in an office, no microwaving fish in the office kitchen. Just no. It's a rule. Marketplace people, you know who you are. To that end, Aspen, from the pages of the Denver Post, this item, the city of Aspen and the Pitkin County Community Development Departments have a shared office space. There's an official letter of agreement on the thing, and it reads in relevant part as follows, quote, "The city shall provide office space at no charge to the county on the third floor of City Hall on the condition that microwaving fish sticks is strictly prohibited," end of quote. Again, it's a rule. Just don't do it. And I'll tell you what, if it's not a rule where you work, well, by gosh, it ought to be. That's all I'm saying. Markets, we told you about already. Brian Allison, Chris Clark, Jake Gorski, Chris Morocco, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.